This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, the 23rd of April, 2008. From Pacifica Station KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Abogado. On today's newscast, we'll hear about how the FBI gets what it wants.
But we have to remember what a perilous undertaking it is when the government engages in domestic spying. Americans don't like it, and for very good reason. We have a long history of abuses. The Red Scare of 1919, McCarthyism, COINTELPRO, Watergate.
We'll go to Ecuador, where a new mining decree has the industry and activists weighing in. And with Pennsylvania behind her, Clinton takes a very aggressive stance on Iran. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Sri Lankan officials say at least 80 were killed this morning as troops made a fresh bid for Tamil Tiger territory. Panaya Monica Vasagam has the story.
According to a military spokesman, the army has suffered its heaviest casualties in a single day since the government pulled out of a ceasefire with the rebels in January. The rebels are known as LTTE, the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam. Brigadier Uday Nanaikara is the military spokesman.
Due to the confrontation, 52 LTT cadres reported killed, 38 soldiers also reported killed and 84 injured.
A rebel spokesman, denying the claim of the military, said over 100 soldiers and 16 rebels were killed in the confrontations. The Tamil Tigers are fighting for a separate state for the minority ethnic Tamils. Both sides offer widely fluctuating casualty figures that cannot be independently verified as the government has barred journalists from entering frontline areas. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Ponnaiya Manikavasagam in Vavuniya, Sri Lanka.
A survey of scientists at the EPA shows that hundreds are complaining about political interference and pressure from superiors who they say want to skew their findings. The survey by the advocacy group Union of Concerned Scientists said more than half of roughly 1,600 EPA staff scientists who responded reported they had experienced incidents of political interference in their work. Gazans narrowly missed a blackout today. Rami Al-Maghari has more.
After a five-day embargo, Israel resumed shipments of fuel this morning. Gaza's crossings remain completely sealed off. According to energy officials, the fuel shipment averted a total blackout in Gaza, as the power plant was set to shut down this evening for lack of fuel. The power plant provides the Gaza Strip's residents with about 45% of their electricity, while Israeli power companies supply the remaining amount. Darar Abu Sisi is the operations director of Gaza Power Plant.
The plant consumes about 550 cubic meters of diesel on a daily basis, producing an amount of 65 megawatts every day.
The fuel shortage crisis in Gaza has been crippling over the past 2 weeks after Israel closed the Nahal Oz fuel terminal in eastern Gaza following a Palestinian cross-border attack. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Rami Al-Maghari in Gaza.
President Bush will nominate the Iraq War Commander, Army General David Petraeus, to head Central Command. The command is responsible for U.S. military operations throughout the Middle East, Central Asia, and the Horn of Africa, including the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. If confirmed by the Senate, Petraeus would replace Admiral William Fallon, who resigned abruptly in March after a magazine reported that he was at odds with President Bush over Iran policy. Iran's president now says he will discuss the nuclear issue with any country, but those who want Iran to forfeit its rights to nuclear energy will, quote, be slapped on the mouth. Saida Jamshidi reports.
President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said today that Iran is ready to negotiate its nuclear program with any country, but will not yield its right to produce nuclear energy. The president previously agreed to talk only with the UN's nuclear watchdog group. The International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA's chief inspector Ali Hainanen, met with Iranian officials this week to discuss detailed and specific allegations against Iran's nuclear dispute, which include explaining an organizational chart linking nuclear project to processing uranium. The next IAEA report on Iran's nuclear program is due next month. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Saeeda Jamshidi.
Thousands took to the streets in Chile yesterday to protest a ban on emergency contraception in the public health care system. Jorge Garatón reports from Santiago.
Yesterday, women's and pro-choice groups organized demonstrations to condemn the banning of emergency contraceptives in the public health care system. Some 15,000 women and supporters marched on Santiago Street in a colorful, peaceful demonstration. Other cities in the country also had major demonstrations in opposition to the ban. The ban comes after the Constitutional Court ruled the emergency contraceptive is an abortion-causing pill that contravenes the Constitution that enshrines life at the point of conception. Yesterday, public health clinics closed their doors also in opposition to the decision. The government accepted the ruling, but municipal governments have begun discussions about selling the pill in their health clinics for 1 peso or no value in dollars. Doctors say they will continue to prescribe the pill as will licensed midwives. Emergency contraceptive cost about $15 in pharmacies, a price prohibitive to lower-income women whose families earn close to the minimum wage of $300 per month. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram. The Democratic presidential primary continues with another win for Hillary Clinton in Pennsylvania. The contest has now moved on to Indiana and North Carolina, while more pressure is being piled on the superdelegates to choose their candidate. Meanwhile, Clinton has shifted her stance on Iran, taking a much more aggressive approach. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports from the campaign trail.
Hillary Clinton's new argument.
Today, here in Pennsylvania, you made your voices heard. And because of you, the tide is turning.
Clinton will use her 10-point win in Pennsylvania to convince future voters on the campaign trail. But she'll also make this argument to the superdelegates, since it's likely party leaders will determine the outcome of the Democratic race. Clinton's win will barely change Obama's advantage in seated delegates, and it's evident that neither candidate will reach the magic number of 2024. Clinton will also make this argument to the superdelegates.
It's a long road to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and it runs right through the heart of Pennsylvania.
Along with Ohio and Texas, these wins in large states with a large number of electoral votes in the general election, placing Clinton in a better position to beat presumptive Republican nominee John McCain, she'll say. Hillary Clinton proved appealing to rural working-class white voters in Pennsylvania, where a majority of the voters were over 45. Women made up nearly 60% of voters, Clinton receiving a majority of them. All these are demographics similar to Ohio, where Clinton also won by 10 points. The Obama campaign counters. They say he won key states of Virginia and Colorado by wide margins and the bellwether state of Missouri. Barack Obama left Pennsylvania for Indiana before the polls closed Tuesday. Indiana will hold their contest May 6th. He told supporters that the road to change is long.
This election is still our best chance to solve the problems we've been talking about for decades. As one nation, as one people, 14 months later, that is still what this election is about.
The race has turned increasingly negative in recent weeks. Clinton flooded Pennsylvania's airwaves with negative advertising, at the last moment showing a doomsday scenario, a montage of negative connotations in the past century. The Great Depression, Pearl Harbor, 9/11, and Osama bin Laden. And on the campaign trail, Barack Obama had shifted most of his stump speech to focus on Clinton. The Obama campaign says that for the May 6 contest, they will not turn negative. While the issues have received little attention in this election lately, Hillary Clinton did address the issue of Iran. Tuesday morning on Good Morning America, as Pennsylvanians began voting, she offered a hardline stance against that country.
We would be able to totally obliterate them. That's a terrible thing to say, but those people who run Iran need to understand that, because that perhaps will deter them from doing something that would be reckless, foolish, and tragic.
Clinton has always said she would engage in low-level diplomacy with Iran, but has often refused to discuss tactics, often saying it's irresponsible to do so. Tuesday, she openly discussed the possibility of a retaliatory attack. In an ABC debate last week, she opened the doors for this new position by saying she would extend a U.S. offer of retaliation to many countries in the Middle East if Iran were to act against them. It's unclear whether these comments had anything to do with Pennsylvania results, but Clinton's win has prolonged the race for at least another 6 weeks, until the last state's vote. For Free Speech Radio News in Pennsylvania, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The government keeps coming up with new ways to get the information it wants, even about U.S. citizens, even about people who haven't necessarily done anything wrong. The Senate committee discussed a recent report about abuse of national security letters, one way the FBI collects information without any court approval. FSRN's Tanya Snyder has the story.
National security letters are requests for information usually made by the FBI to businesses or organizations. They've become another hot-button issue in the long-running dispute over the U.S. government's ability to spy on its own people. At today's hearing, Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse said he thought these letters were the next big civil liberties issue this country would have to address.
The privacy of American citizens is a core value in our society.
National security letters are limited in scope to what is called metadata. That means that if you call your mother, a national security letter won't yield the government information about what you talked about, but it will know that a phone call was made from your number to her number at a certain time and date. That's metadata, and it's not protected by the Fourth Amendment. If they think you and your mother might have been plotting a terrorist attack, they can then pursue more information. But Gregory Nogheim of the Center for Democracy and Technology says even metadata can be too personal.
Not all metadata is created alike. Some of it is particularly sensitive. Yesterday, I applied for a loan at a bank. The records that I gave to the bank might be regarded as metadata. I had to give them my tax return and a lot of other sensitive information that frankly shouldn't be available to law enforcement without a really good reason.
National security letters have become a favorite tool of intelligence agents looking for information they might not be able to get through other channels. Committee Chair Patrick Leahy was alarmed at the numbers.
The Inspector General found NSL use has grown to nearly 50,000 a year, and nearly 60% of those NSLs are used to find information about Americans. It's a major change in the years since 9/11.
Senator Arlen Specter, the highest-ranking Republican on the committee, noted the NSLs are used as a trump card when the courts say no.
The FBI sought records from the FISA court, twice refused. And then the FBI goes to a national security letter based on the same information. Well, that sounds wrong to me.
Specter went on to express his frustrations at the administration.
We simply can't chase the executive sufficiently to have effective oversight.
But James Baker, who worked for the Justice Department for 17 years on national security, said that agents will always find a way to get the information they think they need. He cautioned against adding more restrictions to the national security letters.
They are charged with and have tremendous pressure on them to prevent the next attack, as we all know. And so if national security letters are too difficult, well, let's see if we can find something else. So the volume will drop with respect to national security letters. It'll be a less effective tool. But your insight into what's going on, the Congress's insight, will just change. It'll be harder to conduct oversight of those kinds of activities. And I urge that you worry about that.
Republican Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama agreed that adding more restrictions to intelligence gathering could make America less safe.
And how we're in this deal where we want to put more burdens on people trying to protect the American people from an attack is beyond my comprehension, and I'd object to it.
An inspector general's report and a follow-up audit by the FBI itself documented serious abuses of NSLs from 2003 to 2006. Gregory Nogheim says these violations were predictable, given the powers granted the intelligence agencies under the Patriot Act.
Self-policing doesn't work. Going to a judge makes a difference.
Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin has offered a bill to reform the way NSLs are used, restricting the types of records that can be obtained by an NSL without a court order, and ensuring that the intelligence gathered really is essential to a terrorism case. James Baker countered that the NSL structure should be scrapped and a new national security subpoena should be created. Feingold didn't see that as a solution.
I can't imagine how this is a response to, you know, we just barely dodged this bullet in the last round, and for this to be a response to what we learned about the NSL strikes me as kind of bizarre.
The technology age has made intelligence gathering easier and more fraught with ethical problems. Baker noted that virtually every human endeavor now has a digital record which can be tracked and duplicated and shared. Minimization was mentioned a lot. When does the FBI stop listening to a conversation, and when do they destroy data they've been holding on to? There are no hard and fast rules on these questions. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tanya Snyder in Washington.
You are listening to Free Speech Radio News. Visit our webpage at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. Ecuador's National Constituent Assembly approved a new mining decree last week, which purports to suspend all large-scale mining exploration until the executive government rewrites the country's mining law. It's been estimated that the decision could result in the cancellation of up to 80% of existing mineral concessions without compensation. In response, the executive government of President Rafael Correa is both trying to comfort companies with a pro-mining stance while assuring the Ecuadorian public with promises of greater state participation, but the industry and activists are on their toes. The mining industry promises to launch a new campaign for responsible mining, while anti-mining activists are keeping the pressure on to implement the decree and lobby to have Ecuador declared free of large-scale mining. FSRN's Jen Moore has more from Cuenca, Ecuador.
Speaking to the National Constituent Assembly last Friday, President of the Assembly Alberto Acosta called their mining decree historic and added that the way that concessions have been handed out is totally irresponsible. The decree orders the Ministry of Mines and Petroleum to cancel thousands of mineral concessions, including those in protected areas, near sources of water, and in cases where communities have not been consulted.
What we have had in this country is a mining free-for-all, which we will never see again in Ecuador. This is what is coming to an end in Ecuador.
Acosta, who has previously said he favors declaring Ecuador free of large-scale open-pit mining, also noted that the current mining law doesn't ensure state royalties and chastised companies for their poor consultation practices.
Sadly, many mining companies have specialized in how to divide communities, in pitting brothers against brothers, and in some places we're on the verge of a civil war. It's our responsibility to recuperate the peace in the country.
Pointing out Acosta's environmentalist tendencies, Patricio Vargas, president of the Chamber of Mining in Cuenca, is worried about how the new mining decree might be applied.
If we go down the line of the interpretation of an extreme environmentalist, this country is crisscrossed by hydrological resources. From Cajas National Park to the Amazon region, it's one big watershed. So if we see things from this perspective, mining activities won't be possible anywhere.
The Chamber of Mining in Cuenca includes members such as IAMGOLD and the International Minerals Corporation, both Canadian-financed transnational mining companies. While Vargas acknowledges that the mining decree will clean up speculation that has plagued the sector, he's still cautious despite pro-mining statements by the executive government in recent days.
Here we find a worrisome trend toward nationalism and statism. Even before things are figured out, they're saying that they will offer back the concessions that they've taken away from us to the public. Who's going to want to invest?
Minister of Mines and Petroleum, Galo Chiriboga, was reported yesterday saying that the largest projects will go ahead and that concessions in which mineral reserves have been found will not be revoked. Vargas concluded, saying that they have their work cut out for them so that the good companies are not lumped in with the bad.
It's necessary for us to begin a campaign because people here still don't understand how beneficial and necessary and indispensable mining is.
Anti-mining activists have also been responding to the decree. On Monday, they held marches and demonstrations across the country. In the southern city of Cuenca, hundreds participated, calling the decision an important outcome of their struggle. Nidia Solis from the National Coordinating Committee for the Defense of Life and Sovereignty noted its significance.
They are reverting to old practices by which deceitful and illegitimate concessions were given to transnational companies, as well as national subsidiaries, hidden behind a supposed interest in the progress of our communities. But this has really been about very particular interests and the plunder of our country.
She stressed, however, that the decree was not easily made and will be difficult to implement. It's also only a step toward their aim of declaring Ecuador a country free of large-scale mining. The position of some assembly members is favorable, she says, but recent remarks from President Rafael Correa lambasting their organization stand out in contrast.
The president himself has called us foolish to think that we can leave these minerals on the ground, and has indicated that the government is interested in operating mines in the area of the biggest reserves. It's worrisome, but I think it will motivate us to achieve the necessary political pressure in the assembly and to raise awareness about exactly what's at stake with these projects.
With activists and affected communities preparing for a new stage in their struggle and industry positioning to further back their investments, the next couple of months appear difficult. Support for large-scale mining from the popular president lends strength to the idea that mining can finance development in Ecuador. However, with many profoundly concerned about the costs that such an industry will incur for local communities and the environment, upcoming stages in this battle are sure to be tenacious. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jennifer Moore in Cuenca, Ecuador.
FBI Director Robert Mueller sat before the House Judiciary Committee today, where he touted a plan to demand internet service providers keep users' records for 2 years to be available for review at a later time by law enforcement. As FSRN's Naji Mujahid reports from the Capitol, Mueller also responded to various inquiries for more than two dozen representatives.
Among the many powers of the FBI, some of them include the ability to combat crime, initiate investigations, and conduct surveillance on U.S. citizens. Since September 11th, that power has increased along with an increase in resources, presumably to reinforce that power. Today, the House Judiciary Committee convened a hearing to question the FBI director on their operations. Inquiries were made in regards to internet security, online sexual predators, mortgage fraud, torture, surveillance on citizens, particularly fellow congressmen Renzi and Jefferson, human trafficking, the Gina 6, and the subprime crisis. One recurring theme throughout the morning was the issue of increased gang violence and the role of FBI gang task forces. Congresswoman Maxine Waters.
This gang problem has been going on for many, many years. I know you've only been here for so many years, but it doesn't appear that you're successful in breaking up gangs and stopping violence.
Despite that sentiment, Ms. Waters will go on to beseech Mr. Mueller to come to California and help with gang violence there and to firm up the FBI gang task force already in place. Khalid Samad of the National Council for Urban Peace, Justice, and Empowerment says an increased police presence, FBI or otherwise, is a flawed strategy and advocates for what he calls an urban policy initiative that would, among other things, increase job availability and preparedness.
The dope game is on the downside. That's why the robbery game and the killing is going up. So if we had a real serious urban policy initiative, we could turn this thing around. But you got these short-sighted, narrow-minded people want to invest in prisons and more prosecutions and, you know, minimum mandatory and all that dumb stuff. That doesn't end no stuff. That's not no urban policy.
Another topic that garnered a lot of attention was the lack of response to the problem of online child sexual predators, exemplified in an exchange between Mr. Mueller and Florida Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, in which she questioned him about the diversion of funds from the Innocent Images initiatives to other FBI operations. Director Mueller committed to nothing beyond future closed meetings with some of the representatives in the preparation of reports to those who requested them. Reporting for FSRN, I'm Naji Mujahid of the D.C. Radio Co-op.
Strong animosity is brewing over upcoming November elections in Colorado because of a controversial anti-affirmative action initiative making its way onto the ballot. If adopted, the amendment would end all affirmative action programs, including equal opportunity measures in higher education and public employment.
Similar anti-affirmative action initiatives have also been introduced in Nebraska, Missouri, Arizona, and Oklahoma. Founder of the American Civil Rights Coalition, Ward Connor Lee, is spearheading the national effort to end affirmative action. The California millionaire has had success in the past with similar measures in California, Washington, and Michigan. However, Connor Lee has come under sharp criticism by voters and pro-affirmative action groups who question the unethical nature behind the petition process. Dozens of Colorado voters who signed the petition supporting the Colorado Civil Rights Initiative, also known as Amendment 46, claim petitioners lied to them in order to convince them to support the measure. Blake Wesley is in Denver and files this report.
When 25-year-old Colorado resident Dara Barwell signed a petition to put Amendment 46 on November's ballot, she thought she was supporting a measure ensuring equal opportunities for minority groups. But she later found out she was mistaken.
I signed the petition not knowing that it was actually an anti-affirmative action measure.
Burwell says the language of the petition was deceptive, and the petitioner made her believe she was supporting a pro-affirmative action measure.
I was deceived.
Former petition circulator Jennifer Stucka says petition trainers lied to them and said the Colorado Civil Rights Initiative had nothing to do with affirmative action.
I went, and did my research on the actual initiative and discovered that it was exactly about ending affirmative action. So I was lied to, and luckily I found out before I went out and got signatures.
That gives former Colorado state lawmaker Polly Baca reason to believe Colorado voters are the victims of voter fraud.
This person, Ward Connerly, has been conducting these kinds of initiatives throughout the country, and he has been using these same insidious tactics, and it's the same attempt to defraud voters.
Ward Connerly, a 69-year-old black man, is the main architect behind the so-called Colorado Civil Rights Initiative. The former University of California regent is also backing similar anti-affirmative action initiatives in Arizona, Missouri, Nebraska, and Oklahoma. He says the government should not grant people preferential treatment based on race and gender.
The issue really is a very simple one. Do we want our government to set aside contracts or to require prime contractors to employ as subcontractors firms that are specifically owned by women or minorities and to be required to direct contracts to them? I believe not.
However, Baca says women and minorities have not yet reached an equal level playing field.
You know, all you have to do when you think in terms of reverse discrimination is look at who has the power. At no level of government do you have an overrepresentation of people of color.
But Connerly argues Senators Clinton and Obama are living proof we no longer need affirmative action.
My own view is that we have come an awfully long way. As you look at the candidacy of Senator Obama and the candidacy of Senator Clinton, it does not escape you. It should not escape you that we have come an awfully long way.
But Dara Burwell says Connerly's position is unrealistic and fails to recognize prevailing institutional race and gender inequalities.
It bears no resemblance to the current reality of inequality in this country, nor does it have any recognition of the historical legacy of inequality.
Burwell says Connerly's anti-affirmative action initiative represents everything she stands against, and she wants her signature back. Pro-affirmative action groups are exploring their legal options to defeat the initiative and may have plans to wage a public campaign against the measure. Reporting, I'm Blake Wesley.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. You can send us your feedback. Just drop us an email to comments@fsrn.org. That's comments@fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Tyna Gysi and Monica Lopez. Today's headlines editor is Nell Abram. She's sitting in for Shannon Young. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell. And our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Antonio Ortiz and Puck Lowe. Very happy birthday to Puck. From KPFK in L.A., I'm Aura Bogado.